Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. The Guardians of the Holy Grail show was created by me to clear up some of the many popular misconceptions that have been perpetrated by mainstream media and regarding the secret societies and the Holy Grail mysteries and bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. I'm hoping that through this show I can kind of set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Initiatic Societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar, which over centuries has been either lost or ignored. You can learn a lot more about me and our organization by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. You can, while you're there, you can sign up for our 18-lesson Gnostic Templar e-course. You can become an associate member. You can buy some books. There's a lot of videos you can listen to and watch. There's a lot of written material you can read over and find out exactly what we're up to. One thing we are working on as an organization is to assist in the movement of uniting the various spiritual traditions around the world into a one-world spiritual family. Now, today, as always, if you have any questions for today's guest, feel free to call us on our toll-free line, which is 866-472-5795. Before we get into today's show, I'd just like to remind you all about our tour that we're leading this coming September. It'll be September 20th to the 30th. I'll be co-leading it with my friend Nancy Safford, who was a high priestess of the Magdalene Mysteries and a Knight Templar. We are leading a tour to the Languedoc region of southern France and also northern Spain. We believe that the Languedoc region is really primed to give up some of her ancient secrets right now. For many thousands of years, this region has been a kind of a reliquary and a bastion of the for sacred artifacts and mysteries of the goddess tradition that some believe are interred within its. There's a huge terrestrial pentagram there. Now, within this huge five-pointed star, there's legends that state there's another Solomon's temple that was built to scale and then buried there. There's also legends of priceless relics that may include the body of Mary Magdalene and some version of the Holy Grail itself. As many of you might know, upon this land once ruled descendants of King David when it was known as the Jewish Kingdom of Septimania. And it was here that the goddess-loving Cathars and the Knights Templar once observed their ablutions and performed their ancient and heretical, or so-called heretical Gnostic rites. In its heyday, the Languedoc region attracted goddess worshippers from all over Asia and Europe who converged there to celebrate the mysteries of alchemy, gnosis, and the divine feminine. So, Nancy and myself, we believe the goddess is now calling her children back to the Languedoc in order to assist in the restoration of her tradition and help retrieve some of her ancient wisdom and relics, perhaps, that are hidden there. I believe that the secrets that are discovered in Languedoc and around the world right now are laying the foundation for the coming year of 2012, which is the threshold year that will then bring on this new era of light and wisdom around the planet. Our tour is going to take in some very important places in the Languedoc, such as Rennes-le-Château, Montségur, Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, which is where Mary Magdalene and some of the other disciples of Jesus landed in France. Also going to Montserrat, which is famous for a lot of Templar rituals and initiations there. There might be some versions of the Holy Grail that are hidden there, and there's a famous and very powerful Black Madonna there that we're going to visit. And we're going to be there during the equinox and during a full moon time, so it should be very, very powerful. We're going to do a lot of ceremonies, a lot of rituals, and I'm going to be sharing a lot of the information out of my new book, World Gnosis, The Coming Gnostic Civilization. So we hope that a lot of you can join us. I think it's going to be a really pivotal tour, and I'm already very excited about it. If you'd like to know more and you'd like to register for it, please go to this website, www.sacredsitesjourneys.com. Okay, so for today's show, we're going to be discussing, you know, the ancient heretical or so-called heretical information that up until recently people were afraid to talk about. But now this heretical information is being researched, and it's being shown to be accurate and essential in understanding the truth of our history. My guess is one half of one of the what I consider to be the greatest research teams on the planet today that are both researching and writing international bestsellers on this ancient heretical information. My guess is Clive Prince, whose partner Lynn Ticknett couldn't unfortunately be with us today as she was taken ill and required some immediate surgery, and she's now recovering in a hospital back in England. So our prayers go out to her. As many of you know, the team of Ticknett and Prince have published a slew of bestsellers that include their groundbreaking book, The Templar Revelation, which was actually one of the principal influences behind Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. They've also written The Sion Revelation, The Stargate Conspiracy, The Turin Shroud, How Da Vinci Fooled History. And their most recent book is The Mass of Christ, Behind the Lies and Cover-Ups About the Life of Jesus. I first met Ticknett and Prince back in 2007 when I invited them to speak at a conference I was organizing on the Holy Grail in Glastonbury, England. I have, however, been a fan of them for many, many years. Their research has uncovered for myself and my Templar brothers and sisters in our order much previously heretical information that now many of us are really taking for granted as being true. So we really have to thank them for that. So greetings, Clive, and welcome back to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Hi, Mark. Yes, very good to be back here. And the first thing I must say is that Lynn is really sorry she couldn't be on tonight. She was looking forward to talking to you and to your listeners. Unfortunately, she can't. As you say, she's in a hospital in London at the moment. Hopefully, she should be home tomorrow or the day after. So she's recovering well. But she did want me to say, you know, how sorry she was that she couldn't be here.
So we're all going to miss her, and we're glad to hear that she is recovering nicely. And you can let her know she can make it up to me by coming on later on. How's that?
Absolutely, absolutely. She'll be delighted. Yep.
Okay, great.
I shall do my best to cover for both of us tonight. But
I'm sure you'll do a great job.
Here it goes.
Bye. as you did when Lynn couldn't make it to the Glastonbury conference, and you filled in.
As you were talking about the Glastonbury conference, I was remembering that. But you must get the impression that Lynn's a kind of very sickly person. In fact, she's not. She's one of the healthiest people I've ever met. I think he's just unlucky with her. She really does kind of look after herself. And
I'm starting to feel like maybe I'm bad luck every time I invite her to something to take down ill.
let's not go there. I do know, as she got sick this time, telling friends about it, everyone was going, but their actions, but no, Lynn is never ill. This, we don't believe you. Things can catch up with all of us, however much we look after ourselves. So, she's recovering, and so yes, we must definitely make sure that you get her on your show, just so you know you're not a jinx.
Okay. Well, I look forward to having her on next time. Anyway, Clive, we talked a bit last time about your book, The Mass of Christ, and within that book, I guess you expose a lot of the inaccuracies and untruths about the legend of Jesus. So what's been the public response to the revelations in that book?
It's been a good response. A lot of people have found what we've had to say interesting. A lot of people it's got people talking and debating, which is really the main reason we write. It's not to say, look, we write a book and say this is what we think is the truth. But the main thing is to put the information out there and get people talking about it. So, generally it's been a positive response. The kind of mainstream churches, as you would imagine, have just ignored it. The mainstream churches are having their problems from all kind of other directions at the moment. So,
right.
And the main thing is that, to get people actually thinking about, particularly when it comes down to a figure like Jesus that's really kind of ingrained into our kind of Western culture, that we're all kind of brought up with these ideas from the beginning, as early as we can remember. And we're handed these things as if, they are, well, I was going to say gospel truth, that's a bad pun there. But, a lot of people aren't aware of how many of the things that are supposed to be true about Jesus have actually been shown from historical research not to be accurate at all. On the other hand, there's other parts of the Jesus story that have been shown to be absolutely accurate. And it was Mask of Christ is really our attempt to summarize all that and bring out what we think is important in the Jesus story, which of course involves all the other characters around him, like Mary Magdalene and John the Baptist and Peter and Paul and all those others.
Well, I know that Lynn was excited about writing this book. It's one that she'd wanted to write for some time, I guess. Has it been as popular as your other books?
It's certainly not been as popular as Temple Revelation, which was, it's really that's the thing we're best known for. It's just about, there's a paperback edition just about to come out in Britain. It's always been in paperback in the States. People are reading it. It's not there in the same terms as, or the same level as Temple Revelation, some of our other books, but it's getting there. It's getting a lot of attention, and that's really what we're after. Because it is something that we both did want to write for a long time, and it was really the kind of follow-up or the fallout from the Da Vinci Code and things like that that gave us the opportunity to write it. Because before then, publishers were a bit kind of uncertain about whether that kind of book was something they wanted to publish.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, of course, you're constantly writing about two of my favorite figures in history, John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene. Since we've talked last, have you found any more evidence that may indicate that John was the true Messiah or a co-Messiah with Jesus?
There's no new research since we finished the book, but in fact, the information in the book we think absolutely proves the fact that, well, we believe that John the Baptist was the Messiah, wasn't even a co-Messiah. And I think the evidence, even from conventional Christian sources, as well as from the more unconventional sources, all converges on this fact. Because even if you look at the standard Gospels, even if you don't go outside of that into any of the Gnostic Gospels or any of the more controversial sources, it's very clear that even the story they tell shows that Jesus, people are only interested in Jesus because he was a follower of John the Baptist. People, that includes his opponents, people are only hostile towards Jesus because he was continuing the work of John the Baptist that they thought they had stopped. And if you look at it all the way through, in the early part of Jesus' story, he's constantly stressing the fact, John started something, I'm continuing it. John was taken, John was killed. I'm taking up what he was going to do, and I'm going to bring his work to completion. So certainly in the early part, the whole reason Jesus had a following is because he presented himself to people as the person that was going to finish what John had started. Now that to us points to the fact that it was John who was supposed to be the Messiah, supposed to fulfill that role. We can talk later about what Messiah actually meant to all the different groups of people who were around at that time, it was John that was supposed to be the one that people thought was the one. When something happened and he got taken out of the picture, Jesus came along, picked up that movement, continued it. There seems to have been a great deal of controversy at the time about whether Jesus took that role as John's successor legitimately or not. It seems that a lot of John the Baptist's followers and disciples didn't think that he should have done that, didn't think that he had the mandate to carry that work on. But that's certainly the way Jesus started his mission is, I'm the person that's going to finish what John started. That's why you should listen to me. That's why you should follow me. That's also why the authorities were afraid of him. And I think there is this idea that you mentioned about them being kind of co-messiahs. And I think maybe they end up being portrayed that way. But certainly the way Jesus came in and took up that message seems to us more to be that it was John that was the Messiah. And they had to kind of come up with this idea of a co-messiah to kind of explain why Jesus had to carry on that work. I don't know if that fits with the work that you've done, but that's certainly the way all the sources for us converge on that scenario.
Right. Well, can you tell me, Clive, what would you say is like the most persuasive source of evidence? What's the most persuasive document or source of evidence that you found that would prove that John was truly the true Messiah?
Probably the best one. I mean, strange enough, the best sources are actually, surprise a lot of people to hear me say this, the actual New Testament Gospels. But the New Testament Gospels as they were originally written. And one source that was particularly important to us was discovering that there is actually around a version of the Gospel of Matthew that's actually an original Hebrew version. And it's got several differences to the version that ended up in our Bible, which has obviously been through a process of translation. This original Hebrew version, most of it, 99% of it is exactly the same as the version we have. All the differences are to do with the relationship between Jesus and John the Baptist. And all the real changes are in the words that Jesus uses of John the Baptist. And if there were two really prime examples. There's a bit in the Gospel of Matthew that we have in our conventional Bible, where Jesus says of John the Baptist, all the law and the prophets prophesied until John the Baptist. Now, thinking about what that means for a moment, the law and the prophets are the text and authorities by which the Messiah was going to be recognized. So that's what that meant. So he's saying the law and the prophets, they all prophesied until John the Baptist. That's what we have in our Bible. In the original Hebrew Matthew, what Jesus says is the law and the prophets prophesied concerning John the Baptist. And the change of that one word from until to concerning changes the whole picture, because what Jesus is actually saying there in the original version is these texts and these authorities that gave us all the signs by which the Messiah would be recognized were talking about John the Baptist. Now, someone's edited that very early in Christian history and changed one word but changed the meaning entirely. There's a second one also in this original Hebrew version where Jesus is talking about John the Baptist, and he uses this phrase that John had come to restore all things, which you think, well, not quite sure what that means. In the original Hebrew version, that means John the Baptist came to save the world. So in two parts there, you've got Jesus himself saying John the Baptist is the savior of the world. John the Baptist was the person that was the Messiah that was prophesied in Jesus' own words. Now, Jesus' followers have changed those, you know, just a couple of words there, and changed the meaning entirely. And if we accept the Hebrew version as being the original, and I think historically the evidence is overwhelming that it is, you've got a completely different picture of the relationship between Jesus and John, and also the way that Jesus is portraying himself to the people. He's the person that is, he's almost, if I use the analogy, he's to John the Baptist a bit like St. Paul became to Jesus. The person that, you know, Paul was the person that came along afterwards and bigged Jesus up to the crowds. And in the same way, in his time, Jesus seemed to have been the person that went around bigging up John the Baptist. So from the sources we've got, probably the most important one is this older version of the Gospel of Matthew.
Maybe you can comment on this, Clive. I always wondered about the very beginning of the Gospel according to St. John, where he's talking about in the beginning was the Word was God, the Word became, took body, took a form, and came to save the world. And do you think that in the original New Testament that they were referring to John the Baptist?
They could be. There's some doubt whether all the books that we have in the New Testament, like any book we have from history, has gone through a process of being edited, revised, changed around. And it's thought that the Gospel of John has, as we've got it, has been through a couple of revisions. So it was originally written one way, and then people came and changed bits around or added bits. And there's some dispute about whether that original in the beginning was the Word part was there originally or was added on later, and that the story originally began, as Mark's Gospel does, just with the appearance of John the Baptist. So it could be that... in the beginning was the Word was originally talking about John. But there are certain other parts of John's Gospel that do show very clear signs of having been rewritten later, like with the Hebrew, the Hebrew version of Matthew, that it was rewritten later specifically to downplay the significance of John the Baptist. There was a few examples throughout John's Gospel, and this is something that was actually picked up by New Testament scholars, generations ago, that they can see that whoever's writing John's Gospel has set out to counter certain beliefs about John the Baptist that were current at the time that Gospel was written. And those beliefs that they're trying to counter about him are ones that are set out very clearly in other documents, as in, for example, the Clementine recognitions, which I know is something that, that you talk about in your book. You know, there's this whole thing going on of people talking about, people talking about John the Baptist being the more important one, so that the followers of Jesus are changing their documents to present another picture. It's a kind of tussle between the followers of two great leaders. And it's probably that time that something went wrong, and what was supposed to have happened got fractured and flawed, which is why it kind of ended up in so much of a mess with, you know, you end up with a church based on, you know, the following of Jesus that ends up doing some very kind of, bad things to try and suppress Gnosticism, all these other heretical ideas as they deemed them. It's probably this, something went wrong around that time is the way that we look at it. You know, it's something to do with the connection between Jesus and John the Baptist, the way their two groups of followings disputed over who was the right one to that everyone else should be following. As the message went out to the public, it all kind of got a bit, you know, it got fractured. And clearly something went wrong along the way, because we ended up with the kind of church that we did. You know, I don't think there's much dispute that it's, you know, the church has been responsible for some fairly pretty, you know, bad things over the centuries in suppressing truths and information.
Right. Well, of course. Well, you know, in our order, there's the belief that some of the heretical documents of relating to John the Baptist were passed down amongst the Johannites, and that some of them might actually be in the basement of Roslyn Chapel, having been taken up there by the Templars. Do you have any idea where other such documents related to John might exist? I assume maybe there's some still hidden in the Egyptian desert, I suppose.
There could be all kinds of things underneath the sands of Egypt, you know, because, you know, discoveries get made every now and again of things. The main problem there is trying to catch them before they disappear into the kind of black market in these ancient scripts. You know, it's like this Gospel of Judas that came out a couple of years ago that had actually been around for a long, long time. It had just been, you know, traded amongst dealers in this kind of thing, and the public never got to know about it until somebody actually went and finally made it public. So there's probably all kinds of discoveries out there to be made. Suspect that among the holy books of the Mandians in Iraq and Iran, and well, scattered around other places now, who, as you know, are the existing contemporary Gnostic group people that consider themselves to be the followers of John the Baptist and the heirs to the, you know, to John the Baptist following. You know, a lot of their sacred books and texts have been translated and published in the West, but by no means everything. So there's probably information out there. And we're certain that some of these texts, even simple things like this this Hebrew version of Matthew that I was talking about, that even though it's only slightly different to the version that we've always been familiar with, the changes make a very profound difference where you look, where John the Baptist is concerned. And that's not even been a hidden book. That was actually, that was passed through Jewish communities in Europe for centuries and centuries and centuries. And most scholars that have looked at it assumed it was just a Hebrew translation of the Christian Gospel of Matthew. It was only when, this was only within the last 20 years, when some historians stopped and looked at it very carefully and realized that this is written in Hebrew, but it's not a translation of, if you like, our Gospel of Matthew. It's actually the original one that just got passed down the centuries. Now, that was something, if you like, hidden in plain sight. It wasn't buried in a vault somewhere or underneath the sands of Egypt. It was just a text that was, you know, passed around quite openly in Jewish communities until somebody realized what it was actually saying. So there's probably a lot out there that's just in libraries, not secret libraries even, that nobody's really looked at properly. So there's lots of information out there.
I think one of the biggest revelations that I've come across over the past few years is reading the Mandean Book of John, where it talks about John having a wife and, you know, having a slew of children, which is really quite the opposite of what we associate with John. But I wanted to actually ask you about that, because apparently it says in the Book of John that John was married to a woman named Anhar, and recently, I guess there's a movement now among certain researchers saying that Anhar may have been from Petra, and that John himself may have also been a citizen or even a leader of Petra. Have you found any information to corroborate these ideas?
Specifically on that, no. That's you saying that there's a connection with Petra. To be honest, that's the first time I've heard that. But it would make a great deal of sense. Just to go back a step and say, like you, when we read the Mandean Book of John and it said that John the Baptist had a wife and children, yeah, we were kind of, no, this is not John the Baptist, not the one that we know from the Bible. And then you kind of stop and think and say, well, why do we have this image that John the Baptist was this, stern, ascetic, almost hermit-like character? And it's really because the writers and editors of the Gospels were so uncomfortable about telling us too much about John the Baptist. They couldn't leave him out because he was far too important to Jesus' early career. People knew that he was important. But they didn't want to say too much about him because that would encourage the people that said John was the Messiah to, it just encouraged them a bit too much. So they actually minimized the information about John as much as they could. And the effect of that is he appears to be this kind of very, well, he didn't have a family, he didn't have friends, he just lived out in the desert. It's a very similar process to what happened to Jesus when they wrote Mary Magdalene out of the Gospels. You end up with the impression that he's a celibate, and of course we now know that he's not. Similar things seem to have happened with John the Baptist and with Anhar. But going on to the connection with Petra, why it would make sense is that the reason that John the Baptist was taken by Herod and imprisoned and eventually executed, the reason we're given in the Gospels, we know from other contemporary historical sources, was wrong. The real reason that, it's an incomplete, they don't give the full story. The real reason that John the Baptist was taken, imprisoned, and later executed was because he posed a political threat. And we're not going into this huge detail of it, but if you remember in the Gospel account, it said that what had happened was, he'd criticized the fact that Herod had married a particular, the widow of one of his brothers. And when you look at other sources that were written by, Roman chroniclers of the time, what the problem actually was that in order to make that marriage, Herod had divorced his previous wife. That was the issue. Now, the wife that he'd divorced was the daughter of the king of a neighboring kingdom called Nabatea. Now, his capital was at Petra. And by making this, by criticizing the marriage, just to put in an important bit of information I left out, the fact that Herod had divorced the princess, the Nabataean princess, had actually caused a state of war between him and the king of Nabatea. Where John the Baptist was preaching, the River Jordan, is the frontier between those two. So by criticizing the marriage, he's actually basically trying to get the population on the side of the Nabataean king. Now, you're saying that seems to establish a connection between John the Baptist and the kingdom of Nabatea. And as I said, the capital of that king was actually at Petra. So if his wife came from Petra, if John the Baptist's wife came from Petra as well, it shows he's kind of got a family connection with that kingdom. So it would make sense. The information's far from complete. You have to make a few sort of guesses along the way, but they're educated guesses. But a connection with Petra would make a great deal of sense from that perspective. There is something to do with John the Baptist and that kingdom that is there, but we've never been able to identify precisely what it is. So that's an interesting lead that you've given us there.
Well, part of that theory is also the belief that Mary Magdalene may have been the daughter of John, because Mary or the Magdala of Mary was a town in Ethiopia, which apparently was part of the Nabataean kingdom at that time. So a little bit more grist for your mill right there.
Yes, I mean, it's you can tell there's some kind of consistent story coming out there. I think, as you know, the precise relationship between John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene is something that we've been thinking about for a long time. And in the end, we can make guesses. You know, perhaps Mary Magdalene was John's daughter, perhaps, you know, some other kind of family connection. In the end, there's no specific source to answer that, so you have to kind of leave it at guesswork. If you're looking at it from that purely, you know, what can we establish actually using historical sources? But there's certainly some connection there. You know, it's not, these people, John the Baptist, Jesus, Mary Magdalene, were all in something together, and it was something that the disciples of all of them didn't quite get as well. It's something that was there was an inner secret to them. All this comes across very clearly from purely historical sources. So something's going on there, and maybe we should be looking more towards Nabatea now, to see what was going on there. Very, very powerful kingdom. You don't hear much about it when the story of Jesus is told now in historical terms or in movies, because it's all about Rome. But Nabatea was a very powerful, very powerful kingdom at that time, very rich.
Where are you going to find
battles?
Where are you going to find information about it, Clive?
There's a whole lot of stuff in the British Museum about them. We should be looking there next, I think. And it also should be a good place to visit. Never actually been to Petra, I'm ashamed to admit. I bet you have.
Well, I'm actually planning to go this fall. I haven't been yet, but I'm planning to go. Yeah.
Oh, right.
It's definitely been high on my list for a while.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think we're both going to be doing some research around the Nabataean kingdom for a while, so let's stay in touch.
Yep.
and share what we find.
Absolutely. Yes.
What the skull that you often find with Mary, such as in her painting at Rennes Le Chateau, do you think that skull, some people think that that's the skull of John the Baptist. What do you think about that?
Again, it's an idea that we've certainly considered and thought about and has something going for it. Of course, the problem you always have with interpreting symbolism is to get inside the mind of the person that created the symbol, that particular painting. because obviously different things, different symbols mean different things to different people. It's trying to work out why did, well, in this case, you know, the priest Sonia, who put that image in his church, what did it mean to him? Where did he get the sources of that from? Depicting Mary Magdalene with a skull is a very kind of traditional piece of her iconography. But then you start to ask the question, why is it? What's it, you know, what's it talking about? In the end, it's with a lot of symbolism, you can't prove what it means in the end. There's certainly the idea of this connection with the, you know, the skull of John the Baptist, that the head of John the Baptist is a you know, a big symbol or a big artifact that flows through this story. You know, John was beheaded, and there's various stories of what happened to his head, the fact that his head, you know, continued to prophesy after his death. You know, many stories about that. So, you know, there's, again, it all kind of hangs together in a consistent way.
Well, one of the goals of many Templar orders, certainly ours, is to find out the location of John's head, which we do consider to be the Baphomet that the Templars are associated with. But apparently there's five or six cathedrals and mosques around the world that say that they have the right head. So, you know, where do you even begin with that research? There's a mosque in Damascus that said it has it. There's, of course, the Amiens Cathedral, St. Mark's and Venus. Where do you even start with that research, you know?
Yeah, that's always the problem. You know, how do you ever prove that any one of them is right? Very easy to find a relic and eliminate it as a forgery, as a fake, you know, if you date it and it's obviously not as old as it should be. First of all, you've got to get your hands on these relics. They're always, as you say, in churches or mosques. The one that the Mandaeans regard most highly is the one in Damascus, and they used to make pilgrimages there to, in the belief that, you know, they could actually hear it prophesy. I suppose that might be one of the tests of it. But certainly, like you, we fully believe that the head idol, the Baphomet of the Templars, was the head of John the Baptist's, or perhaps a representation of it. But that's, you know, even some of the Templar knights at the time of that they were interrogated said that this head was the head of John the Baptist. A representation of it, or you could say it's something they believed that it was the head of John the Baptist, but certainly that seemed to be the key relic of the inner group of the Templars. One of the very strong pointers that the Templars were part of this Johannite tradition, this tradition that believed that John the Baptist was either the real Messiah or perhaps the co-Messiah, but certainly had come into this information somewhere along the line. So this information is still around. It's still spreading. And like you, we'd love to know what happened to that Baphomet, to that head.
Well, I know in the depositions of the Templars during their trial in France, they mentioned the power that emanated from the head, that it could grow plants in the middle of winter even. They had such power to it. And, you know, when I think about this, I think back to India and why did they entomb the great masters rather than cremate them? Well, because their skeletons, what's left over of them, continues to emanate this incredible spiritual power that they had when they were alive. And so I would think that if we're going to find some of these true sacred relics, whether it's the head of John or the head of Mary or maybe the skeleton of Jesus, it's going to have tremendous power emanating from it. And I for one went to Amiens Cathedral and I stood in front of that head for literally 3 hours and I virtually felt nothing, you know, from it. So I cannot believe for that reason that it's the head. So my belief is that if we find the true relics, they're going to have tremendous spiritual power emanating from them.
And for that reason, according to the Mandians, the head in Damascus does have that power. But you actually think of it from another perspective, that anyone who had these things, if they do emanate such a power, they wouldn't put it somewhere the public could feel that. It's going to be in a vault, hidden away. It's going to be buried deep, really, so that people can't pick up on that. The other thing I wanted to say there, as you're describing the things that were attributed to the Baphomet, to the head of the Templars. Of course, it's very striking that the terms that they describe it, or the powers that they attribute to this, are pretty much exactly the powers that are attributed to the Holy Grail. And there's another line of the research that we did that was in Templar Revelation makes it very clear to us that certainly in the earliest Grail stories, this is something I talked about in Glastonbury when we met at the conference there, that the original stories of the Holy Grail were actually talking about either the head of John the Baptist, or a coded way of talking about the secret, the truth about John the Baptist. They are Johannite messages in code. Maybe not all of the Grail stories, because lots of different versions are written, but the original versions were Johannite codes telling the Johannite truth in the form of the Holy Grail, in a way that could be passed on without the church suppressing it. So there's another very strong connection there with an important part of European or Western esoteric tradition.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps we're looking in the wrong place. Perhaps it is hidden someplace if it does possess that kind of power, and it's only going to be revealed, obviously, at the right time, the right place. So.
Well, yeah, and if anyone's going to reveal it, I think you're the person to do it, so I think you're going to track it down. But,
well, I'd like to think that. I'm not so sure. I like to think that.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
So, you and Lynn have done a lot of work around, I know about the bloodline from Jesus and Mary. Have you found any really specific documentation about a French royal bloodline that the children of Mary married into and then created this lineage? Have you found any really authoritative documentation of this?
The short answer is, is actually no. There's no specific documentation about this at all. We do believe. The evidence is very strong that Jesus and Mary Magdalene, were involved in what we might call an intimate relationship. We're not entirely sure they were married, I have to say, but that they probably, almost certainly did have children. And to Lynn and I, the more interesting thing about the bloodline is that it started. Not necessarily that it's still around today or any of those things. The real point of it is that a bloodline started because they had children, which tells you that something about the relation, well, something about the character of Jesus, the character of Mary Magdalene, and the nature of their relationship. So the important thing to us is that a bloodline was started, because it completely undermines the image of Jesus that was fed by the church. As soon as you know that Jesus was involved in sexual activity, that he could father children, then you begin to ask, like earlier we were saying with John the Baptist, why do we think he's this ascetic monk-like character? Why do we always think that Jesus was this celibate, rather kind of aloof individual that didn't really appear to connect to the people around him? Well, you suddenly realize that, actually he did connect in very immediate ways with people. So that's the important thing for us, is that what the bloodline starting tells us about what was really going on. What it tells us about the way the sources have been distorted to you know, remove a lot of this material, and the motivations by the early church for wanting this stuff removed. Why didn't they want us to know that Mary Magdalene was Jesus' wife or lover? You know, what harm would it do? And then you start to get a picture of what it was that the early church was trying to do to its followers to, you know, continue its, or to establish its authority. So in terms of the continuation of the bloodline, I mean, no, there are suggestions here and there that, of important bloodlines, but there's nothing you can actually pick up and say, this is the smoking gun that, you know, proves that.
Well, the idea of the genealogy is always associated with Baron du Saunier and Rennes Le Chateau, and I know that, you know, in recent times there's been people that have been down there poking around trying to find these genealogies and to find out exactly what did Saunier find, and apparently, I mean, some of the townspeople seem to be able to produce, like, documents that, you know, Saunier found. I don't know if they've been able to produce a genealogy, but I guess they've shown some. They've been able to produce some for Ben Hammett to look over. Have you spent any time around there? Checking out that area and seeing what you can find.
I spent a lot of time around Rennes Le Chateau and around the Languedoc generally. This was more the time we were researching Temple Revelation, so I'm saying this would be 10, 15 years ago now. We've been back since, but not for, I think the last time we were there was about 4 years ago. So we spent a lot of time around there, sort of digging, when you were describing the trip that you're doing in September, I was kind of thinking of getting very envious because it's a great area to be in. You know, anyone that gets a chance to go on you with this trip should really go. It is an absolutely kind of an area just steeped in history, well, mystery really, and a sense that any of these mysteries that we start researching, like Templars, like the Holy Grail, like Mary Magdalene, like John the Baptist, alchemy, whatever, you always end up in the Languedoc and somewhere around Rennes Le Chateau, and that can't be coincidental. So, yeah, we spend a lot of time down there. Been very interested in what Ben Hammett's been doing and discovering yet recently. Been talking to him every little while. So he's coming up with some very interesting discoveries. Like all these discoveries, it takes time to actually kind of sit there and work out what it means. It's initially get excited, but then you have to kind of step back and actually kind of think really what it's about. For example, if somebody had found a genealogy, if Saunier found a genealogy, you still have to ask, how did the person that wrote that genealogy on a piece of paper know that what he was writing was accurate? What sources was he getting it from? You know, so there's a lot of questions when we approach it from, as Lynn and I try to do, we approach it very much from a historical point of view. Not that we're dismissing any, you know, kind of more spiritual approaches. It's just the approach we've always tried to take is there are all these traditions around, you know, in all these different initiatic societies and so on that pass down these traditions. And Lynn and I have always looked at it, let's go and see if, just on purely historical grounds, that we can find something that will either verify or completely contradict these traditions. And with our work, the two things that we found that really do stand up are the traditions concerning Mary Magdalene, which wasn't, you know, that new when we wrote Temple Revelation. It had been discussed before, but. And more importantly, because it's something we hadn't really seen before on a historical ground, was the Johannite tradition, which was something that, you know, we've heard talked about a lot. But when we went around and said, okay, let's forget the tradition part of it, forget what the secrets that are handed down, let's approach this purely historically. Does the historical evidence support that tradition or not? And we found it supports it absolutely, you know, indisputably. So it's that to us is the, you know, important, the really important part of what we do.
Well, it's as I'm sure you know, when Ben Hammett was led on to this cavern, this cave, by clues that Sonya left behind, and apparently one of the clues said that the Knights Templar were guardians of the body of Mary Magdalene and brought her body to the Languedoc, which is, of course, one reason that Ben Hammett believes that the mummy he found in the cave is in fact Mary Magdalene. So does this kind of also fit in with your research that you know, the Templars were the guardians of the body of Mary Magdalene?
We've always thought that, you know, there's a whole thing that whatever the secret of Rennes-le-Château is, that it's connected with a body, an important body that's buried somewhere. And most people kind of assumed or tried to make the case that it's Jesus' body. And we've always said, you know, if there's a body around there, it's much more likely to be Mary Magdalene's than anybody else's. Going further, you know, any further than that, for example, we think that there's a very strong case. You can't prove it absolutely. Again, from a historical perspective, you can't prove it absolutely, but it's a very strong case to back up the legends that Mary Magdalene went to the Languedoc region, to the south of France, and that's where she died. So it's something that we certainly think is, you can't prove it, but we think that's very likely to be true. So once you've got that, you know, those traditions came down, people passed that information on, maybe in the form of myths, of Mary Magdalene being there, being in that part of Europe, dying in that part of Europe. You start to think, well, if that got passed on, then surely a memory of where exactly she was buried, what happened to her body, that must have been passed on. One of the things that impressed me about these legends when we were down in the south of France is sometimes how precise they can be on a very local basis. There's a place in Marseille where the locals will point to one specific little kind of square and say, that's the place where Mary Magdalene once preached. And it's not one of those things that's, you know, the big tourist sites associated with Mary Magdalene, like her cave or Saint-Marie de la Mer. It's a, you know, it's a tiny little out of the way place, but the kind of local memory that's been passed on is, you know, 2,000 years ago, Mary Magdalene preached there. Now, if the local memory can pass on something about where she stood and talked, it surely must pass on things about where she's buried. And, you know, later the Templars come along, other groups come along. They pick up on these myths that have been handed down.
Right.
I say you can't prove it, but it seems to us, you know, very likely. You know.
Right. Well, it's certainly important to take into account the myths and the stories and legends of the indigenous people. And you know, what you just said kind of reminds me of Nicholas Roark taking his trek up into the Himalayas and Tibet and Mongolia and being shown sites where Jesus supposedly sat and preached and did his work. So it's, you know, that information of the indigenous people is what I tend to put more stock in than anything else myself, because I think that they have the true wisdom, the true knowledge, and of course, what you do find is that it's quite often it's 180 degrees different than what we're taught.
Yes, nearly always. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But anyway, we could go on and on about John and Mary, but I think for the rest of the show, I'd like to find out what your current research is, you and Lynn, what you're working on these days.
Well, at the moment, we're working on a book that is really going in a slightly different area, but not much. Looking at us diving into the science versus religion debate, or religion stroke spiritual esoteric world, and it's kind of looking at our take on that, the relationship between science and the esoteric world. and also looking at some of the latest scientific discoveries, the way that science is moving, and whether that kind of fits or doesn't fit with the esoteric traditions, particularly the Hermetic side of things, which also has its link back to the Johannites and the Gnostics. So that's really where we're going. It's a book that, we haven't yet finished it, and it's obviously been delayed now because of Lynn's illness a bit. So it probably won't be out until next year. But you know, obviously, we can talk a lot more about it then when it's out and people can read it. But we're making some very exciting discoveries there as well. That kind of, and it all fits into the whole structure of things that we're building up that started with Temple Revelation and just asking some of these questions about esoteric traditions, the traditions of various secret societies, the initiatory societies, and what they're actually based on. Where did they get their information from? It's part of that whole stream of research that we've been doing for 20 years now. In fact, we've been working together. So,
right. Do you have anything else going on? Certain conferences, speaking events, videos, films.
We don't have any more little cameos in Tom Hanks movies.
They haven't hired you on for any more big movies, huh?
We're still working on that. We're still working on our Hollywood moment. We're going over to Romania, to Bucharest, at the end of June to launch another one of our books over there, or translation of it, and do some talks to some of the.
Oh, really? Yeah, it looks like we'll probably be setting up a Templar Preceptory there in the next year or two. So,
Oh, that's fascinating. So, obviously over there there's quite a, Bucharest, quite a thriving esoteric scene.
Yeah, there is. It's amazing. We just actually set one up in Bulgaria, which really amazed me that they wanted us to come over to do it there. So, yeah, all over Eastern Europe, it's really happening.
It surprised us to find it as well, because obviously Eastern Europe had been somewhere we didn't know a lot about until quite recently, until it all got opened up there, and to find out that these orders, the same orders that are around here that have obviously been connected with yours, are kind of thriving there and had been thriving all through the kind of communist era, obviously in a very underground way, was fascinating. And they're doing a lot of work there. They even have TV shows dealing with this subject, which is something that we don't have certainly in Britain. It's a good place to be. So, we're looking forward to going over there. We've not got too many kind of talking or lectures set up at the moment, mainly because we just need to get this book done, get it done and out the way, and then we can move on to other things. But we're looking at doing documentaries on various subjects that have spun out of the different books we've done, so mm-hmm. We've got to be busy, basically. It needs to get.
I'm certainly hoping that one of these days you can do a little tour of the U.S. You haven't been actually done that yet, have you?
No. We've apart from really one tour promoting one of our books many years ago. We haven't. It's something we would, we would love to do. We nearly did a couple of years ago, again off the back of the Da Vinci Code and our connection with that, and that kind of all got actually sort of thrown into. It didn't happen in the end, actually, thanks to the U.S. Immigration Service sort of bureaucracy. The whole thing went crazy. We had to actually cancel all the stuff, but we think someone in the Immigration Service must have read out one of our books and didn't like what we were saying. So
I hope that it happens, and I hope that I can, in some way, help to facilitate it. I would certainly like to host you all here in Sedona, in the future, and hopefully I'll have a venue where you can come and speak.
That's something we would very much like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be just fabulous. We actually have we have a caller on the line. Here's a question for you, Clive. We have Alexander from New York is on the line. Hello, Alexander.
Oh, hi, Mark. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. And Clive, thanks for being on the air.
Hello.
I had a question. Yeah, I had a quick question. You'd mentioned that most of these traditions somehow lead back to Languedoc, and just to lead into Mark's trip a bit in September, which sounds really fascinating. I was wondering if you could maybe explain a little bit about those mysteries quickly and their relationship with the Cathars, maybe.
Well, the Languedoc is just somehow everything heretical or esoteric always seems to happen in that part of the south of France, down near the Spanish border. Why? Who knows? It might just be that it's a long way from Paris, so it's harder to keep control of. But certainly, it was the area that the real heartland of the Cathars. They weren't exclusively there. I mean, it spread to other places and even into Italy. But that was where the whole thing really started. Then, of course, you've got the suppression of the Cathars by the Inquisition, which has left scars that haven't healed to this day. And, of course, whenever you get a suppression, you get things driven underground. And when things get driven underground, they become obviously secret, but often sometimes get a bit distorted and turn into a slightly different version of what they were supposed to be. The very first witch trials in Europe happened in that area. Again, whether this is a coincidence, we don't know. Maybe the Inquisition were there. They, having got rid of the Cathars, they needed to find somebody else to fight, so they started that. It was the area that was the majority of Knights Templars' holdings in Europe were in that area, and there were very strong signs that the Templars were actually going to try and create their own kingdom there. And whatever period you go to, whichever line you follow, you always end up being drawn into that area of France, and it's can't be coincidental. There's obviously something going on down there. It is a very special place. It just seems to be a magnet for all this, for all this stuff. Even down to the fact you do have these legends that Mary Magdalene lived out the last days of her life there. We don't think they're entirely legends. We think they're based on truth. But you only think, why did she go there? How did she end up in that part of? It was all part of the Roman Empire then, so there's a kind of logic there why she went there. But it's just as we all know, there are places that do act as magnets for this. Scotland is another, particular parts of Scotland, really. As to why, your guess is as good as mine or as anybody's, but certainly there's something about that place. And certainly from the point of view of visiting there, there's an endless amount to see, whatever you're interested in. There's every time you go there, you discover something new, another church with another relic in it, or another, it's just absolutely fascinating. So anyone that gets the chance to go, I would absolutely recommend it.
Well, Alexander went offline, but I'll thank you for him, and I'm sure he's very appreciative of your answer. This about wraps it up for now, Clive. It's really been a great pleasure to have you on the show, as it always is and always will be. And you can tell Lynn that you represented both of you extremely well, and I knew you would. there was no doubt in my mind.
Thank you. No, it's always a pleasure to be on. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm just thinking, I can't believe that the time's gone so quickly.
It's 70 minutes has gone by. It just in a blink of an eye, it's all over. It seems like so. This is why you have to come back on, because we can't get it done in one show. You know, we probably couldn't get it down to 100. So you probably go, you have to, you hope you're ready to come on all many times. because you're exactly the kind of people, the kind of researchers that I want to talk to, that the people, the audience wants to listen to. I mean, it's just a blessing, you know, to have you people on the planet
It means a lot. It's obviously very encouraging to us and what we do to hear that. And, I've thoroughly enjoyed being on tonight. And, yes, we'll come back as many times as you want us.
Okay.
I'll make sure.
I'm going to hold you to that, Clive.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll be in touch with you, and thanks again for being on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Bye for now. So that was Clive Prince of Lynn Pignett and Clive Prince. Lynn is I mentioned before at the beginning of the show, was not able to come on today because of some sudden sickness that forced her to have an operation, and so she's recovering in the hospital. So her prayers to her are always welcome. And so that's our show for today, and we'll have one equally, well, maybe not equally, but nearly as exciting and informative next week. And so hope to have you back again. And in the meantime, always remember that the true Holy Grail is not outside, but inside your own heart. And that's the place to look. So bye for now.